You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, I'm Robert Wright. I run the Non-Zero Foundation, which produces all the shows on Blogging Heads TV and Meaning of Life TV. We host a variety of voices, some of them pretty unorthodox, and we encourage dialogue that is sharp but civil. We think fostering constructive conversation is especially important now that America and the world are looking kind of fragile. If you agree that our mission is important, I hope you'll consider helping us shoulder the cost. You can do that by becoming one of our cherished patrons at patreon.com/nonzerofoundation. That's NONZEROFOUNDATION. Thanks. We need your help, and we deeply appreciate it. Hi, John.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm just fine, considering the state of the nation and the virus and all that stuff.
Well, the state of the virus is healthy. Unfortunately, it's our enemy, so that's bad news. Well, let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. This is The Wright Show. Available on both streaming video and via audio podcast, John. We're going multimedia here. You are John Judas, well-known writer about politics and stuff. We're going to talk about your book. Let me show our viewers, those who aren't listening on podcasts, what it would look like if they downloaded it on Audible, as I did. The book is called The Socialist Awakening. Nice green there, that jacket.
Here, I'll show you my copy, too. It's the actual print book.
Yeah, that's a little clearer. I'm getting some weird. Reflecting off of the glass of my smartphone. So never mind. I withdraw that visual. So there is a socialist revival. Apparently, we've all heard of Bernie Sanders. He's made the word respectable again. And you are kind of perfectly positioned to write this because you were not only a socialist before it was cool. You were a socialist before it was uncool. You were a socialist when it was cool, like in the early 70s and stuff, right? Isn't that true?
Yes. Yes. Even before that.
I was not going to force you to give any further clues as to how old you may or may not be.
I'm almost exactly Bernie's age. 15
really?
Days apart, I think.
Really? Well, I got to say, you're doing as good a job as he is of remaining sharp. What is the secret?
I don't know. Maybe athletics. That's what they say. And I read these New York Times op-eds occasionally. They say that sports is the key. So I play tennis a lot.
You do play tennis?
Yeah.
Who's going to win the French Open?
It's probably the virus.
I don't think so. I think it's too late for that. Anyway, the people will know the answer to that by the time this airs. So, yeah. So anyway, let's talk about – now, you and I were together at the New Republic, okay, in the late 80s or early 90s. I think I met you in 88, 89, and you were doing some writing for the magazine, and I think you later developed a closer association. In your book, you mentioned the New Republic as being now among the magazines that kind of represent the socialist revival as having socialist leanings. It certainly wouldn't have been mistaken for a socialist magazine back when you and I were there. And in fact, there weren't many things that would have been. The word socialist had pretty much been excluded from the conversation. And I guess in listening to your book, I came to realize more than I had before that there's some question as to, you know, to what extent does the revival of the word represent the revival of the ideology, and to what extent does it represent a loosening of the definition of socialism, right?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, it's the same thing with populism or nationalism. There is no definition of socialism. It's changed over the years. There's different kinds of socialism, but what we're experiencing now, Bernie voters, I mean, there was even before Sanders ran for president, you could see these very odd results among young people. you know, you ask, are you favorable attitude towards socialism? You get, you know, 45, 50% of 18 to 29 year olds. And now what was that about? That was not about the Soviet Union. It wasn't about the kind of orthodox Marxism that I espoused back when in the 60s, early 70s, that Bernie Sanders did too, where the idea was that you were democratic, but the government basically was going to control all the means of production, all the industry. That's really not what the kids are thinking about. There's still some socialist organizations and things like that that are back in that mold of thought. But Bernie changed, I changed in the 90s as well. And really what we're talking about now is a shift of power from capital to labor, more power for working people, more equality, racial, sexual, economic, ending the incredible disparities of wealth. And when particular kinds of sectors of industry prove intransigent, then government really has to step in, for instance, in healthcare, energy, transportation, but that, you know, still a private market, obliteration of capitalism as such, but socialism is something really that exists within capitalism. And that's the change. That's a big change in people's thinking.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So maybe just to put a little more flesh on that, you could tell me how close I am to being a socialist. Who knows? Maybe I already qualify. Let me tell you. So I'm for universal healthcare. I would like to see a way more progressive tax structure. I would like that money used to significantly supplement funding for public education. You know, the public schools in low income areas. Even to the extent of steering, giving them more money per student than schools in less, kind of challenging areas, you know, which would mean a significantly increased role of the federal government in the funding of schools, which now are very dependent on local property taxes, which of course vary. I'd be happy to see, it's not a hobby horse of mine, the government paying for college education, but I'd be fine for that, with that and, vocational school. I'd be happy to see the government be the employer of a last resort, you know, ensure that everyone who's capable of working can work and at least at a minimum wage and those who aren't capable of working, you know, should, you know, get, I think, be guaranteed a comparable minimum level of income. Am I already there? Am I a socialist?
About the workplace? Should workers have more say over what's happening in their workplaces? Should there be more labor unions? Should there be some labor representatives on boards of directors? Again, I think these are all elements of socialism within capitalism. And you know, again, the big disparity and the reason I think Bernie would have had a lot of trouble had he gotten the nomination is that for the generation of people who grew up in the Cold War, socialism really still is identified more with undemocratic, with Soviet Union, Venezuela, places like that. But again, for the kids, they see it, see something very much like what you're talking about. And you get the older politicians, let's say Elizabeth Warren, you know, there wasn't really a dime's worth of difference between her and Sanders. I mean, there was, you know, people would try to parse out this and that, but they were very similar, or between Sherrod Brown and Sanders, or between the members of the Progressive Caucus in the House and Sanders. But, you know, for a lot of them, if they called themselves socialists, they would be in trouble politically. If you, you know, if you were Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in a gentrified area of Queens in the Bronx, you'd be fine. But again, if you were in running for the Senate someplace, you might be in trouble. So what I talk about in the book is both socialism and a kind of shadow socialism. And you're a shadow socialist.
Shadow social. Okay, I've now found my label. Thank you for that. I know how to introduce myself at parties. Should we ever have parties again? Okay. So then to some extent, the label has loosened, but then there's also been, something concrete and real in terms of an actual shift of attitudes about policies, labels aside, right?
Yes.
And go ahead.
You see it even among, I mean, you see it for Joe Biden having to really move leftward in this election and the kind of things that he's proposing. Again, tax reform, that would be redistributive, public option for health insurance that could function as a kind of Trojan horse for Medicare for all, economic patriotism, controlling what happens with, corporations, making it harder for them to move overseas, encouraging them to produce here, encouraging unionization. All these things are elements of a leftward, you know, Bernie socialism, if you like.
Although saying I won't raise your taxes if you make less than $400,000, I don't think would be enough to get Karl Marx on your side exactly, right? I mean, it seems to me that
it's incremental. And, you know, Biden is not even by our standards, a flaming liberal, but he's had to move. It's not the same guy who was sponsored the bankruptcy bill that made it harder for ordinary people to, you know, go bankrupt. So it's he's had to change. And, you know, my view is that we're in a kind of very similar situation that we were in, late 20s, early 30s, both in the United States and Europe, where we're going to have a lot more government intervention in the economy. And the question is, what shape is it going to take? I mean, you get Mitch McConnell. I mean, they agreed to $1 trillion spending bill 6 months ago. I mean, that was inconceivable 10 or 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So there is going to be big government. There is a shift. And, you know, what form is it going to take? Is it going to be redistributive? Is there going to be more power for workers? Or is it going to be a kind of, again, enormous subsidies for business, but looking aside to what happens to the rest of the society?
Yeah, that reminds me of one thing that's not unrelated to this, but it seems to me that there used to be the pretty widely accepted idea that government deficits become a problem pretty soon. I mean, it wasn't, you know, you could find a lot of Republicans who believed that and a lot of Democrats who believed it. Now, Republicans kind of began evading the question back with supply side economics when they would claim that, oh, don't worry, you cut taxes, the deficit magically doesn't go down because tax cuts pay for themselves through incentive effects and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. That's, it's far from clear that that's actually the case, but it helped them get into the tax cut business. It seems to me that now, especially, I mean, beginning maybe with the 2008 recession, but especially with the pandemic, people, I don't want to say they don't worry about deficits anymore, but you think there's just a totally new attitude out there?
Yes, there's a new attitude, but the same kind of questions that prevail, which is what kind of deficits are they? And if they don't encourage economic growth, if, for instance, they go towards wealthy people putting their money in the bank and it going nowhere, then you are eventually going to get inflation. You are going to get, because you're not, or you'll get huge trade deficits, one or the other. It's not going to work out for the benefit of the country. So we should run deficits, but they should go into people's pockets so they can, who need to spend, and they should go to encourage economic growth. You know, the usual litany with infrastructure and stuff like that. So I think that's an important aspect. And if you do that, then you can keep deficits under control. And we also have the advantage that the dollar is an international currency. So we don't have the same kind of pressures that a lot of countries have.
Yeah, I've never understood exactly how that's a get out of jail free card, but everybody says it is. I agree that especially if your goal is short term stimulus, you want to put the money in the hands of people who will spend it. And that's why I think a certain amount of the pandemic relief stuff was kind of wasted. Some of it went to people of a fairly high income level who didn't have any particular way to spend it. But I think there are people that argue with you about whether that even a consumption-based tax cut doesn't have inflationary effects, but I don't want to have that argument. I just want to note
it. Well, it depends on what the rate of unemployment is, too.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And whether there's unused capacity.
Right.
If we're in the 60s and we have, you know, 4% unemployment and the factories are humming and so on, and you have a big deficit, you're going to have inflation. So that's a...
Okay, so back to the underlying causes of the leftward shift that there has been, especially among the young. What do you see as the key factors?
Well, I think the key factor is the Great Recession. And now we have the recurrence of a big recession and a pandemic. That's when you see attitudes of beginning to change. I did the data for progress and YouGov gave me these their raw polling with a little gadget that allowed me to make tabulations, and the biggest concentration of people who have a favorable view of socialism or who even identify themselves as that are not doctors or engineers. They're people who graduated from college but didn't go any farther. Now, these are people who were under tremendous pressure in the last 20 years. You have a combination of student debt and the expectation that you'll get ahead, but those expectations frustrated by the Great Recession. So, that's when you're really among young people. You see not so much, I mean, I don't think the socialism part is as critical as skepticism about capitalism and the idea that if we just let things go, everything's going to be okay. And so I think that you get a lot of skepticism, Occupy Wall Street. And the other part of that is, well, the alternative is socialism, but it's not, again, the socialism of Karl Marx or the Soviet Union that the kids are thinking about. The other factor is climate change. I don't go nutty over climate change. I'm the older generation, but I think for a lot of people growing up, it's very much like the threat of nuclear war was for us in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. It's something very immediate. In a way, it really isn't to me. I'm sorry, but I don't worry about it. I understand the issues, and I think what Trump has done and all the EPA is awful, but it's not heartfelt, but I think it is heartfelt. The kids. And I think, again, it's an area where they realize if you just let the oil companies, et cetera, do their business as usual, you're going to be in trouble. So we need something else.
And we're defining kids as, well, kind of the age of your kids, right? Which is what? And they're in their late 20s, 30s.
My measuring is 18 to 40.
18 to 40
is what
you mean by...
I have to apologize to 40-year-olds for calling them kids, but, you know...
You're 40, you're happy to be called a kid. At 25, you resent it. At 40, you welcome it. Okay. And now there's... That's interesting. So climate change... I mean, you know, in the first round, socialism, ecology... In fact, that word became a word in the late 60s, early 70s. Environmentalism became a thing... It in a way for the first time as a big thing. I mean, you know, Rachel Carson, Silent Spring was early 60s, but it really started mushrooming late 60s, early 70s. So environmentalism was part of the first round, right?
Right. Earth Day. 1970, I think, was Earth Day. Yeah.
And its function in aiding the socialist kind of awakening is to remind people of the shortcomings of capitalism. The capitalism by itself will not solve all problems.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny. That's something we were taught in college, even when I was, you know, late 70s. None of these economists were trying to turn us into socialists, but they emphasized that there are these things called externalities that the market will not take care of.
Right.
And I guess we're just seeing bigger and scarier versions of those. Now, I assume growing income inequality and wealth inequality is also part of what's driving this and is intertwined with some of the things you've already cited.
I intertwined is the right thing. I don't think a lot of people sit around resentful of the rich as such, but they think they are resentful of the kind of power they have over the economy and over politics. I think when Bernie again talked about a political revolution, he wasn't talking about the armed struggle or people going to the barricades, but he really was talking about changing our political process so that we have the average person has the same kind of power as Steve Mnuchin or one of these other characters, hedge fund people.
Mm-hmm. And so I think you in the book you say kind of the last. I forget what the metaphor is, the last nail in the coffin of non-socialist America or something is the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
Is like,
because it's a situation where we have to spend. And I mean, I have my fingers crossed that they do a deal in the next week and they do relieve people because, it's a life-threatening emergency, not only in terms of healthcare, but in terms of unemployment and what that does to people's morale and crime. You have it. We have to spend.
Mm-hmm. Now, I assume you don't see this new, more moderate socialism as the camel's nose under the tent that will ultimately usher in the old-fashioned kind of socialism. Is that right?
I should hope not.
So you have renounced a certain number of your previous views then?
Well, I know I was always a democratic socialist,
okay.
But it didn't. What happened in my case was that by about 1976 or so, it just didn't make sense to me anymore. I could not make the leap from the way America was to this vision I had of what. It was sort of a vision that you'd have a democratic version of the Soviet Union. Didn't make sense. If you had if government controlled everything, then the political people who were elected would be in a position to maintain themselves in power indefinitely. And that's the kind of situation we see with the older kind of socialism.
Okay. So the model has shifted from kind of Cuba to Denmark and Sweden.
Yes.
And you.
And we should be so lucky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a question. I mean, some skeptics would point out that, yeah, Bernie Sanders is around, but he not only didn't become president, he didn't even win the nomination of the Democratic Party. And in fact, this time around, there seemed to be, you know, kind of a low-ish ceiling on his support, right? The hope had been that as the field cleared out and it became, you know, that his ceiling might increase, but it just didn't.
And I, if you look at, I have some of those numbers in my book. His support among voters, let's say now 45 and older, was strictly limited. He was just not going to win those voters. And that's whatever black, white, Hispanic, Asian. And again, those were voters who were very skeptical about socialism, but also who were enormously concerned about electability. I think this is the first time that I felt in an election that, I'd vote for Mr. Ed the horse against Trump.
Wilbur. We can agree on that for sure.
That really put a ceiling, I think, too, on Bernie's support. And when after he won Nevada and it looked like he was going to get the nomination, that's when all Biden had to do basically was win South Carolina and it was all over.
Yeah. So let me ask you a question that fascinates me. It's about, well, actually, let's first review another of your books. So you've written several books. You've written The Nationalist Revival was, I think, your last book.
Yep.
Before that, it was The Populist Explosion. you keep having to come up with these new words for
for the same thing. Exactly.
You've got Explosion, Awakening, Revival. I think you're done. I don't think there are any more synonyms.
I am done.
It's time
me.
To retire. But yeah. Those were all these nicely crisp, short, Columbia Global Reports books, by the way. So people should know that it's not an immense time commitment to read your book, The Socialist Awakening, or as I have done, listen to it. But, before that, there was a book that you co-authored with Rui Teixeira called, what was it, The Emerging Democratic Majority?
You got it.
And now I think I've, tried to hold your feet to the fire about this in the past, which is that you, it seems to me, and I may recall wrongly, and you can tell me if I did, that you made this emerging democratic majority thing sound simpler than it has turned out to be. It was to some extent an exercise in demographic extrapolation. You said, look at the coalition. We've got we've got blacks, Latinos, a certain segment of the whites. Look at what, how these populations are growing.
Right.
And you just do the math. You just do the right. math, and we'll never have to worry about somebody like Donald Trump being president.
I should have the book on my desk here so I can refute people when they say this.
No, 20 years old? How old is that book?
Yeah, 20 years.
Okay.
It was around 9/11. It was written and published the next year.
Okay.
But we said in the book that, and assumed, and this turned out to be an error, that in order to create a majority that would endure, the Democrats would have to retain, we later made an actual estimate of about 40% of the older New Deal liberal white working class. And it didn't turn out that way. And the 2010 election was critical in showing that the Democrats weren't going to be able to hold that part of the electorate. With Hillary Clinton, it dropped, I think, below 30%. So that's the part. I personally thought that after Obama won in 2008, he would have a chance to build the kind of majority that Franklin Roosevelt did by, you know, bringing us out of the Great Recession, succeeding social programs, but it didn't work out that way. And again, that was my mistake, and I think I misjudged the kind of obstacles that Obama faced in doing that. So, you know, we've reverted to a situation of a kind of unstable equilibrium between the parties, where, you know, the Republicans in off-year elections in 2014, 2018 do pretty well, and the Democrats have a popular majority in the presidential years. It's going to get shaken up in the next decade, but it's not clear yet exactly the direction it's going to go.
Okay. So one, defense of your not getting it exactly right about the emerging Democratic majority would be that if Republicans had held true to their traditional ideology, in other words, if a Donald Trump figure hadn't shown up and changed kind of the Republican talking points,
right,
and really appealed more full-throatedly to the white working class. Although, of course, there were signs of the white working class. I mean, you know, there was movement of the white working class, I guess, into the Republican fold to some extent well before Trump. But his populism really, I guess, kind of closed the deal was the big problem from the point of view of your book's thesis?
No, I think that the Republicans were doing it before. I mean, in 2010 they did it. In 2014 they did it. I think Kasich would have done better than Trump in the 2016 election. Part of the problem wasn't the Republicans, it was the Democrats, that they continued to adhere to a kind of neoliberal view that turned off a lot of these voters, and they allowed this split to happen between the big, really a socio-cultural, but also economic split between the big metro centers of the East, West, and, you know, Midwest to Chicago, and a small town and middle-sized town, America. And, that was a problem with Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016.
Okay.
Now, if we had different electoral rules, if we didn't have the electoral college, it wouldn't be a big a problem.
But, I know it won't surprise for me to tell you that you're not making an original point here.
Yeah, I know. That's right.
So one thing that has happened is the Democratic Party has become a captive of its donor class. Is that one problem?
It was as much a matter of ideas as anything else. I mean, I think that Obama became captive to this idea of business uncertainty and that he can't do anything to ruffle the feathers of the banks and big businesses. And so he was he wasn't as aggressive as he should have been in 2009 and 2010. And they weren't, again, thinking about politics.
But isn't that itself a sign of being captive to the donor class when you're afraid to ruffle feathers at that level?
I think, again, they had an economic theory that and Larry Summers' theory when he's in office, not necessarily his theory when he's out of office, that business confidence is essential to prosperity.
But if you were a good Marxist, you would view these theories as mere superstructure and explain them in terms of base, which would be the Democratic donor class, right?
Right. Well, there are people. There are some theorists in I think his name is Ferguson and Rogers, who have exactly that theory, a kind of money-based theory of Democratic and Republican politics. But I think that ideas play a role. I share Keynes' view of
bad
this.
Bad Marxist. Another line of critique, though, of your Emerging Democratic Majority book would be, okay, you can say that you hadn't anticipated the Republicans increasingly encroaching on the on the white working class, but to some extent that was almost, if not predictable, a nearly inevitable consequence of internal contradictions within the Democratic coalition. In other words, if you look at, like, why is the white working class gettable? Why are they susceptible to some of Trump's talking points? It's part of it is they view immigration as a threat. Well, why is the Democratic Party wed to an immigration policy that many in the white working class don't like? The answer is maybe twofold. One might be the donor class, but also some would point to the Latino part of the coalition, right? So they'd say there was an inherent friction within the Democratic coalition, right? You think it could have been managed, or you think it's not really friction, or what?
Oh, I think it's definitely a problem. I'm not denying that. And it's a problem with trade also. And I think, again, you could put it the donor class if you want, but the a lot of Democrats, particularly Wall Street, Silicon Valley, were very hot on the idea of free trade, in quotes, with China. Mm-hmm. And those were the kind of policies that got the Democrats in a lot of trouble. Or, you know, going back to Clinton and NAFTA. So there were a sets of policies. Immigration also, the guest workers is something that Silicon Valley wanted as much as, Silicon Valley, again, Democrats and liberals wanted as much as anybody else. And the irony of it is, if you look at the polling among Hispanics, the objections to illegal immigration are about the same among whites and Hispanics. There's not a, it's a matter of the Latino lobbies, the immigration lawyers and stuff like that, having an immense amount of power in the Democratic Party. And, you know, that, again, this was a problem that Hillary Clinton had, and that I think it is remediable. which is that, you know, you're for doing something about illegal immigration. We can't have 12 million people in this country who basically are powerless and docile and can be manipulated by employers and are subject to all kinds of hardships. So we need some kind of path to citizenship, but we also need border security. That's not something inconsequential or irrelevant. And the Democrats have continued to ignore that issue. They just say nothing about it. You know, and Trump has made that easy by being so nutty about it in a way. I mean, you know, it's a come. Are you for or against having a, you know, $1 billion wall between the United States and Mexico? And the obvious answer is no. But are you for doing something so employers have to check who they're hiring? Yeah, that's something, again, that's something feasible that the Democrats could be for and that labor unions were for in the past. So, again, I think that there's a way to bridge these differences, but the Democrats have allowed themselves to be too much a party of a particular, again, socio-cultural niche in the United States. I mean, Biden is attractive partly because he isn't. I mean, he is a Scranton, Pennsylvania. I mean, that's an enormous advantage. And I think that a lot of people who might not have voted for, you know, Kamala Harris if she'd been the nominee are perfectly comfortable with Biden. And it's not a matter of black and white. It's a matter of culture and the fact that they think that he understands them in a way that other Democrats don't.
Yeah. I think you're right that Trump, in his various forms of extremeness, has made it hard for Democrats to embrace certain kinds of moderate positions. I mean, they are pushed rhetorically into the opposite extreme. It's like I had never heard of anybody outside the Cato Institute saying they were for open borders until Trump. Right. I mean, because nations never permit truly open borders, except in the special case of the EU within the EU. And yet suddenly you were hearing people act as if you said you weren't for open borders. That meant you wanted kids in cages or something, you know.
Right. And you know, when you get the Democrats, so this question about whether you want to have you're going to have Medicare for all. Does that mean that anybody who's in the country can get care? Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether they're citizens. Now, you know, in Canada, you have to have a residency. You have to have at least an official residency. You can't just go into a doctor and demand care if an emergency is different. But, you know, you have all the Democrats raising their hand and saying, yeah, that's obvious. We should, yeah, allow Medicare for all for anybody who's in the country. So, again, I think that they've gone to the other extreme. You know, and you can get into the stuff about the police, defunding or abolishing the police, reforming the police, transforming them in certain areas and cities where it's a really, really big problem. Yeah, absolutely. But defunding them? I mean, in Montgomery County, I mean, that would make no sense. Why should we do that? You know, we'd have more crime. We wouldn't have any, you know, you'd call 9/11. So anyway, yes. Yeah. Trump has made us a little crazy, and it's affected certain parts of the Democratic Party as well.
Yeah, though I think the defunding the police issue points at something else and kind of draws us back to something that was implicit in what we've been talking about, in talking about the Democratic coalition and so on, which is, I guess maybe it's the question of identity politics. It's the question of the social justice movement's influence on things. And I wanted to ask you about this anyway, because its connection to socialism is the connection of socialism to identity politics. And I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean, some people use the term identity politics is usually used pejoratively, maybe, but people know what I mean. What I mean is... in this context, you know, sometimes having to make a decision about whether you emphasize class issues, economic class issues, or issues of ethnic identity. And I really noticed this in the wake of the George Floyd thing, where people were talking about, I mean, the defunding the police thing, I mean, in principle, that's not an ethnic issue. I mean, lots of people would be affected, good and bad, by the, and we should say, they don't just mean defund. They have ideas about how to reallocate resources. Not as crazy as it sounds, it's just a horrible label politically. But the point is, the rhetoric, first of all, the rhetoric behind that was very much cast in racial terms, because police are racist. We need, to do that, period. And what wasn't, I mean, I guess I hoped that in the wake of, George Floyd, you would hear demands for, like, sending appreciably more government revenue, like, into inner cities and public schools and so on. In other words, the goal should be, I thought the goal, a goal should be, I mean, yeah, police need reform of various kinds, but I thought a big goal should be reducing the number of black kids who find themselves in George Floyd's shoes. That would be great. You know, if you didn't have a history of run-ins with the law and you did have stable employment and you had graduated from college and so on. And it seemed to me it was an opportunity to steer resources in that direction, but probably the politically effective way to do that would have been to also steer resources toward lower income people generally. I mean, build up some support, get some Trump supporters behind this, right? I mean,
We agree on this.
Yeah. So, but talk about the connection to socialism, because classically, if these were classic socialists, they would have been saying that, right? They would have been saying class is the fundamental thing to talk about.
We are in a situation in the United States where we do not have that kind of comprehensive leadership, where there isn't a, where we really have not replaced the kind of, let's say we go from the New Deal ideas to a more neoliberal ideas, market fundamentalism, where the market's more important. We haven't yet made that transition. So that there's a kind of common way that people understand these problems, and they understand them in a way that, well, we can't, let's say, advocate reparations as a solution, because that's going to just blow away half of what should be our base, and we'll end up losing elections and we'll screw exactly the people we want to help.
Right.
So we have to find, again, we have to find common ground, but it doesn't exist right now. Biden is a kind of placeholder. We're going to have a new generation of politicians who figure it out. One more thing. We had this kind of same kind of situation in the late 60s and early 70s in the New Left, where you didn't have a kind of common view of what was going on. And so each of the individual groups, whether they were feminists, the blacks, Hispanics, would adopt the most radical ideas. They would try to substitute their own part for the whole. Similarly here, you have all the particular movements going to extremes. With the environmental movement, I don't know whether, I don't know if Extinction Rebellion is that important in the United States. In Britain, they were advocating, carbon free by 2025. Something, you know, they take all the cars off the road, the heaters, nobody could ride in planes, et cetera. So in other words, we need a kind of common way of understanding how we're going to get the bottom and the middle of society together and overcome the kind of socio-cultural things through common economic program. So I'm just in a long-winded way agreeing with you.
But, two things. I mean, first, your reference to the New Left is interesting. In your book, you say that the New Left, what was called the New Left in like late 60s, early 70s, which was not as much about, workers of the world uniting and these class issues, more about issues of racial justice, civil rights, environment, and so on, that the New Left emerged because we were in a period of relative prosperity, and there wasn't the sheerly economic needs of the lower class weren't as pronounced as they had been once. It occurred to me that if you see today's socialism as in some ways analogous to the New Left, in the sense that it's not emphasizing class-based issues as much, an explanation might be not that there weren't a lot of working class people who felt they were hurting, but that they were not in the same orbit occupied by like young people at college. These progressives, they don't know people. They don't know people in small towns in Missouri, right? I mean, it has to do partly with the growing, you know, people have noted the growing, you know, just kind of cultural segmentation of America. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. And it will take politicians from those parts of America to figure it out. I always used to say that the way the liberals in Canada won would be they'd get somebody from Quebec. They wouldn't get an English speaking person. You know, we need the equivalent of Bill Clinton, some guy from Arkansas who can, you know, bridge. I mean, Clinton's virtue was he was partly Little Rock and partly Yale and Oxford. He could bridge those kind of differences. That's exactly the kind of politics we need. But we're not at that point.
Sherrod Brown.
Well, I like Sherrod Brown. I was doing a Washington Post magazine piece on his presidential run, and I was, you know, in the middle of the draft of it, and I got a call from his press person saying he was dropping out. I think he had some of the characteristics. He might have had problems himself winning the nomination. He's not the most dynamic candidate. But again, yes, somebody like that. That's why I and a lot of people who think like I did fastened on his candidacy.
Do you think any of the challenge, though, involves actually convincing what we've been calling the kids to change their minds about some things? I mean, there are some of the most energetic, politically active, kind of promising political actors in their kind of 20s and maybe 30s, right. Like they really don't see that a label like defund the police is complete political suicide in America for years to come. They don't understand what you said about reparations, which is that would be just deeply divisive and in a way probably wind up helping the Donald Trumps of the world. It's like, they don't have time for these arguments. I don't want to overgeneralize. It seems to me it's hard to get traction for these kinds of pragmatic arguments. And look, I'm sure when I was young, I was resistant to pragmatic argument in certain ways, but it does seem to me that that's part of the challenge because that's where the energy is. And if you can't get them on board, I don't see like Sherrod Brown going to get them on board with these ideas or what? How is this going to work?
Well, that's why I wrote my book.
You know? Oh, your book will do it. Well, okay.
No, I'm not saying my book will do it, but unlike the other books, it was an argument for a position. It wasn't, I mean, my populism book really wasn't that. It was more descriptive and analytical. This one was an argument for what you're talking about and what I've been talking about. It was trying to convince the kids that they have to take a more comprehensive look at it and see what will unite these different parts of the country who, you know, who suffer in many ways common grievances.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so kids, get off our yards and listen to our arguments. Let's see what else I wanted to ask you about. I think one thing a hobby horse of mine. I think near the end of the book, you talk about some issues that need to be addressed at the international level, like environment, but you emphasize that economic labor issues need to be addressed at the national level. My own view is that increasingly we're going to have to find ways to address labor and not just environmental issues at the level of multinational governments in trade agreements and so on. Do you don't do you mean to rule that out, or do you just think it's, you're just not that optimistic about great stuff happening on that front, or what?
I'm not that optimistic. I think the China-U.S. Rivalry is real. And, you know, we have a situation where China, and to some extent some other of the other Asian economies, and this is true too of Germany, have built these huge trade surpluses by suppressing consumer demand within their own countries. And it's hard for me to figure out a way to resolve these issues internationally. I mean, I think that this was part of Trump as a kind of canary in the coal mine. I mean, his China stuff. I think he was addressing real problems. I think his solutions for them have been mostly bogus. But it's a real problem. And if I had to look at the international organizations, there's been just a steady deterioration over the last 30 years since the end of the Cold War. NATO, UN, you know, IMF, you name it. So, yeah, of course I agree with you, Bob, but, you know, it's way, you know, I think we need an intermediate step of nations beginning to understand that there are certain goods that they have to produce themselves, and that they can't just farm out in search of lower wages and less regulation. So supply chains, yes, we have to make a lot of those drugs ourselves.
Let me give you an example of a very incremental version of what I mean, and this will involve giving Trump some credit, although it may turn out that even this is kind of bogus and symbolic, but it was interesting to me. In his version of NAFTA, or whatever he's calling NAFTA, to the U.S., Canada, Mexico, or Mexico, Canada, something.
Yeah, I can never remember.
It's either USMCA or USCMA. He did negotiate in this rule there, his negotiators did, that in order for a car to qualify for free trade within North America, it has to, let's see, I think it's at some percentage of
its
part.
Content rule.
What's that?
Some percent, yes. You can't ship something from China to Mexico and then ship it to the United States.
No, it isn't just that. It was more interesting than that. It's that it's at a certain percentage of its parts or something like this have to have been made in factories whose average wage or minimum wage is something, whatever the details, I apologize. Yeah. It doesn't matter anyway. The point
is the kind of thing it is. Yes.
It affects an attempt to put a floor on wages.
I'm not an expert on these things, and I've seen people poke holes in it and say they're loopholes, but from my vantage point, it was an improvement on what we have. And
right.
I think Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. trade representative, is the one guy from this whole panoply of various characters that Trump has brought in, who has done a decent job.
He seems to be the most capable person involved in the trade negotiations, so far as I can tell.
And he may be the only capable person in the whole cabinet, too. So.
It's possible. So, I don't know. Is there anything else you want to say about the book? If you do, say it. And if not, I may ask you a couple of just questions about contemporary politics.
Oh, that's fine. We can talk contemporary politics.
Okay, so this, let's see, what I can say for sure, this will come out in a week or two, but certainly before the election. And so we should stipulate that right now we're in this weird time where Trump acquired COVID, has now triumphantly left the hospital and done this balcony appearance and so on. So neither you nor I think, purports to know how this weirdness is going to play out. But it is the case that people will see our conversation before the election has taken place. So that's the kind of time frame we're in. I don't know. What are your thoughts on this whole thing? Are you optimistic about the election at this moment?
Well, I'm optimistic that Biden will win the electoral votes. There could be all kinds of chicanery and through lawyers or what have you to try to throw the election into the Supreme Court. I don't know about that. We just don't know what'll happen. But in terms of public support, I think, yes, I think he has the support to defeat Trump. I think that Trump has lost significant support among senior citizens who are very scared by this virus stuff, and among the white working class as well. And you can see it in the polls. So it's not just upper middle class women from the suburbs who have turned against him. I mean, mm-hmm. whole groups of very important supporters of his from the past are going to vote against him.
And you don't think his, like, don't fear the Reaper message is going to work? His new, like, see, I beat COVID, see how easy it is?
We just don't know. I mean, again, this is going to be in 2 weeks. I had the steroids when I had back problems. And
I did
stuff.
Too.
You did
and
too?
And they make you feel really
tennis.
Good.
Yes, yeah. I thought I could. I mean, my game actually improved immeasurably, but I thought, really, I could lift a 300-pound man and throw him across the street. I mean, you just feel buoyant and strong.
Did you have prednisone?
Yes, I think that's what it
was. Yeah, that was what I had, and it was miraculous. It also made me a little bit more of an asshole, so I think a little more belligerent, and I think so. And this prednisone is pretty comparable to the steroid Trump took, I think. So again, these pronouncements are these opinions are a hostage of fortune because things will play out by the time people hear them. But I do think if he stays on this steroid, it makes it less likely that he'll do what some people thought he might, which is come out of this humbler and, I've learned and
we've all been expecting. I thought when he won the election in November 2016, he would, sort of sand off all the rough edges, the Mexican rapists and the judge, all that stuff and act presidential. It turns out that he's rigid in his outlook. And once something works, isn't there a term for this in business? When a business succeeds at one thing, it can't stop doing it. It can't. I mean, that's
the innovator's dilemma or
something. Yeah. So he's basically still in the fall of 2016, build the wall with screaming supporters, making the most incendiary comments about his opponent. And he's also lost his wit. I mean, that's what really struck me about the Biden, first Biden-Trump debate was he was actually pretty funny. He could be, and he could have a kind of self-deprecating humor even at time. Or let's say self-referential. Deprecating would be too much with Trump. But
a little meta.
Yeah.
Like with Hillary, when Hillary said, she said something like, I'd hate to live in a country you were president. And he said, yeah, that's because you'd be in jail. I mean, as Trump witticisms go, wasn't bad. But,
when he used to describe himself as a genius, there was always a double edge to it. He was still on the apprentice. He was still the big boss and he was still acting in TV. There's a way in which those personalities have merged. You could see his face in the Biden debate. I mean, the guy was just full of grievance and resentment and bilious. I mean, he doesn't have that interior anymore that will allow somebody to be funny and to make fun at certain points.
You know, on the point you made about how expecting him to emerge from the 2016 election more conciliatory. There's an interesting, you haven't seen the Errol Morris documentary about Steve Bannon, which consists basically of interviewing. You should watch it. It's interesting. And one thing Bannon says is that when they realized Trump had won, Trump said, I want to try to bring, he says, Bannon says, he said, okay, let's bring the hammer down. It's like, this is now our country. It's like immigration, blah, 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 down the line. Let's lay down the law. Let's do it. And he says, Trump said, no, I want to bring the country together. And he says that Trump then, it was probably the next day or something, like he looks out, I guess he's in Trump Tower and there's these hostile crowds have gathered.
Right.
And Trump started going into adversarial mode. That is Bannon's story, is that Trump planned to become the great healer. Of course, to my mind, that just shows how unself-aware he is. I think he's been so effective at being a bully all his life, going way back into his childhood, that he doesn't get how much people actually hate him. Successful bullies never get the blowback. People bow down in front of them. They don't give him any back talk. And I just think he doesn't understand it. No, a lot of people just really, really hate you. And they're not going to forgive and forget the day after the election.
I mean, Obama had that problem, but he understood what it was to be presidential. Even Nixon, could do it. But Trump really doesn't have it. And I agree with that characterization. That's interesting. I'll watch the documentary, because I think that Trump was completely taken aback by the opposition that still existed to him. And, you know, I would hear people talking about that he should be forced out before the inauguration, and again, harping on his failing to win the popular vote. So, you know, again, I would go back to George W. Bush, again, who didn't win the popular vote and had a lot of people hate him. He still knew what it meant to be president and to try to talk to the whole nation. Trump has proved incapable of doing it. So even if he wanted to do it at the beginning, he just has not had the temperament.
Yeah, I agree. It's to some extent just a temperamental issue. Yeah. Okay. So, well, listen, John, congratulations on putting out another admirably short, crisp book.
Thank you, Mom.
And it's called The Socialist Awakening. I don't think we gave the subtitle, did we? What's Different Now About the Left? Yeah, well, we covered that part.
It's a dull subtitle. I never even remember. Here it is, gang.
Yeah, man, that's a bright green. That's good. You know, they say that green is a bad color for magazine covers. Back when there were magazines, you remember that conventional wisdom?
No,
green didn't work on newsstands, but those were generally duller greens. Yeah. I think even if that was true, you found a green that's going to work.
And there aren't any newsstands anymore anyway.
There aren't those, as you may have noticed. Yeah.
We barely have bookstores.
Yeah. Well, maybe we can reminisce a little off camera after.
It's been fun.
Yeah. And congratulations on the book. And I hope we'll do this again down the road.
Yeah.